the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
If kids are attending school hungry, if they are attending school having been exposed to a high level of family violence in the home before coming to school, they are not going to be in a position to learn well.
Professor Susan Sawyer there, talking about the Health Promoting Schools program, which is being launched by the World Health Organization and the United Nations. Professor Sawyer, who is the director of the Centre for Adolescent Health at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, and two of her colleagues are the authors of new global standards designed to help schools, education departments and governments to implement the program. Dr. Monica Raniti, a senior research officer at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, and Dr. Ruth Aston, a lecturer at the Centre for Program Evaluation at the Graduate School of Education at the University of Melbourne, joined Professor Sawyer and I for a chat about the Health Promoting Schools program. We're talking about health promoting schools. What is a health promoting school?
The formal definition of a health promoting school is a school that is constantly strengthening its capacity as a healthy setting for living, learning and working, which might sound to health professionals as a pretty odd definition, because I think most of us who come from health tend to think of schools as a platform where we might deliver actions for health. But at its heart, health promoting schools is really about seeing schools as a community out of which both learning emerges and health and well-being can emerge when we think of school as a whole school, when we think of the entirety of what can be achieved within a school environment. Different approaches, different language have been used for sort of similar programs. You know, another approach calls it comprehensive school health, but the elements are basically the same. And the key feature is the capacity to leverage the many different ways that schools can promote health. And this includes through curriculum interventions, through creating more positive social and emotional environments at school for students. It includes the quality of the physical buildings and the external spaces in which students spend their days, as well as those more day-to-day interactions that students have with teachers and other students as well.
The fact that we're talking about the need for a health-promoting school suggests we don't have those now. What's the state of play?
What are we missing now? To some extent is an organising framework that makes sense of many of the different elements that constitute a health-promoting school. And to some extent, this is what the global standards that we've just been working on have aimed to achieve. But they have really come out of a series of bodies of work which are really demonstrating what some of those barriers are. So there's a whole lot of pieces that we don't have. But I might hand over to Monica, because she really led the work on the barriers of implementing health-promoting schools, and also the enablers that I think could be helpful to perhaps consider now. The concept of health-promoting schools really emerged out of the Ottawa Charter for Health Promotion in the mid to late 80s, and then the World Health Organization has promulgated it as a concept since the mid-90s. But here we are, you know, 25 years later, and in terms of the current renewed approach that these global standards and the accompanying implementation guidance are really constituting are a whole-of-UN approach led by WHO and led by UNESCO jointly with the initiative really to make every school a health-promoting school.
So, Monica, the concept's been around for a while. What have been the barriers to getting this up and running in a consistent way across different countries?
First, we need to think about, well, what does successful implementation look like? You know, what does it mean? And I think, firstly, I'll just say that it's important to recognise, as Susan has sort of said, that HPS is not a discrete program or a discrete curriculum with a start, a middle and an end. You know, it's the way the school operates, it's that atmosphere, you know, it's a school that's continually responsive to the needs of its students and the school community. And so there's no end point. You know, we're talking about this complex system which as, you know, coming from the health sector, I'm very well versed in RCTs and discrete programs, but here we're talking about this complex system. And there are lots of schools that are continually working on being a health promoting school, and they're really great examples of this. There's countries where there's strong educational policies that include health and well-being. They're doing this in an integrated way with the whole school approach. But in saying that, there's some barriers around implementation. And when we're thinking about implementation, we're thinking about difficulties fully embedding HPS. So maybe curriculum and the physical environment are supporting health and well-being really well, but the social emotional environment and maybe school policies need a little bit more work. Or maybe we're having difficulties sustaining these activities over time. And at a country level, we're having problems with scaling up. Over the past 18 months, we've been doing a body of work looking at this question and some others. And as part of that work, we did a global policy review, and we also did a systematic review of some primary studies looking at the barriers and enablers to implementation of HPS around the world in low, middle and high income countries. And what we found from reviewing just over 70 studies worldwide, mostly from high income countries, as you can imagine, was that there were some common barriers and enablers that came up. And these didn't seem to be too different between high and middle income countries. Of course, there are contextual issues that we need to consider, but some of these were around relations within the school and support from the school as an organisation. So, for example, was there a culture of positive energy and collaboration between all individuals in the school that were working towards a common purpose around HPS? Were school staff given enough time and resources for planning and implementation and considering all the competing demands? We also found the real need to prepare and plan for implementation and sustainability from the outset rather than an afterthought. So setting up some of those management and leadership practices and policies to support this. So things like creating student committees and councils and providing regular training for teachers.
What does the education sector have to say about all of this? What are the educators saying about this concept?
Well, perhaps I can offer some thoughts here. I think we did involve teachers and educators in the work that we did, as Monica has mentioned, so that's something to consider. But looking here to Australia, they are doing it already. It is already a requirement for what it means to be a high-quality teacher here in Australia, if we look at the standards for professional teachers as well. And I think some of the recent commitments that have been made, like making sure that there's a mental health practitioner in schools, making sure that there is investment going into capital works that focuses on building teaching and learning environments that do promote social and emotional well-being, as well as providing a physical environment in which students can learn. So I think that that work is already happening. Perhaps something that is needed more is looking at how we can build systems that can support teachers and school leaders in particular, rather than placing the burden solely on the educator, building systems that actually can support them to really work towards what is quite a broad visionary goal, which has a lot of altruism that sits behind it, but does rest upon what it means to be a high quality educator. So I think focusing on professional learning, as Monica mentioned, and looking more at even initial teacher education and developing educational curricula that endorse and support health promoting schools.
When I first started at the Centre for Adolescent Health in 1995, when George Patton was leading the Gatehouse Project at the time, which was a large randomised controlled trial that was being undertaken in 26 secondary schools in Victoria. And whilst the language of health promoting schools wasn't used in relationship to that study, it was absolutely a whole school intervention that was deeply embedded in this notion of health and education working incredibly closely together. And one of the striking reflections that I remember at the time with me as a very junior paediatrician back then and not having any experience of schools was it was led by, apart from George from Public Health, the co-lead was very much from the education sector. And what the teachers who were providing the feedback about was that they were saying that they came to this pretty cynically, you know, this is all with a focus ostensibly on improving student health. But what they all came away with feeling incredibly surprised about was that it enabled them to focus on their true role as teachers in terms of supporting students to better learn. So that what I found incredible was the extent to which these teachers were embracing this body of work because they said that their students engaged so much better in the learning tasks that it achieved both their primary goals as teachers, which is about, you know, promoting learning outcomes, but they could equally appreciate that it was clearly endorsing health outcomes as well.
Is there much argument these days about the value of good health to educational outcomes?
Yes and no. And Ruth, I'd be interested in your perspectives from the education sector a bit. I think when you sit deep down and unpack these issues, no, I don't think there's any issue at all, at least in high-income countries like Australia. And I think we have a, you know, relatively sophisticated set of schools across the country and of folk who are in leadership roles and departments of education who can appreciate the benefits of education for improved health across the life course, but also can appreciate that if kids are attending school hungry, if they are attending school having been exposed to a high level of family violence in the home before coming to school, they are not going to be in a position to learn well. And for kids who are struggling, as so many kids currently are in the current pandemic, who are struggling with emotional distress and high rates of depression and anxiety, then these students are not necessarily able to bring their best selves to school for learning outcomes, as is the case for kids, for example, LGBTI kids who are struggling in relationship to aspects of sexual identity and orientation, for whom, again, schools can either feel very safe, respectful places which they can learn very productively and positively, or they can be bullied out of town and choose to leave school, which is the worst outcome for their learning outcomes as well as their emotional health. But if we look at schools in low and middle income countries, many of these schools are struggling with much higher staff-student ratios. So teachers are very poorly resourced, often don't have the time available in the day. And the natural response of any teacher in that scenario is to say, no, you know, I'm concentrating on reading, writing and arithmetic. Why would I be doing anything else? And I think this is a failure to understand the intrinsic benefits, if you like, of health for learning and learning for health, which lies at the heart of what health promoting schools are about.
I'm chatting with Susan Sawyer, Monica Raniti and Ruth Aston about the newly launched Health Promoting Schools Global Standards that they have written for the World Health Organization. If you would like to read the standards in detail, they will be released by WHO on Tuesday, the 22nd of June. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can catch up with all our published episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts. You can also subscribe to our feed wherever you get your favourite potties, as well as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Please do leave us some feedback. Back to our chat. You touched on it there, Susan. Why is now the time to be talking about this? Is it about COVID?
The why now is in the context of the Sustainable Development Goals and the fact that there is an ever-growing proportion of children and adolescents in low- and middle-income countries who are now much more likely to spend 12 years at school as do children in high-income countries. So it's recognising that, in addition to family, that school is a really important community out of which both learning outcomes and health can emerge. None of us had any idea when we first took on this work, what was it, 2 years or so ago now, that the pandemic would be on us just at the time that we're launching these standards this week. But I think every parent, every school, every young person now, if they didn't have a fine level appreciation of the significance of schools for both learning outcomes as well as for health, surely everyone's got it now. The penny must have dropped. Having said that, though, the challenge for schools, and I think you were sort of alluding to this a little bit as well in terms of the challenge for teachers, is that too often, you know, there'll be a particular prominent issue that becomes the what I refer to as the problem du jour. You know, it's this day's problem, it's this week's or this month. And, you know, it is emotional health and mental well-being at the moment, obviously, and has been for some time with awareness that we now have of the extent of mental disorder in young people. Last year, it was around safe schools and LGBTI issues. Next year, it may be about substance use. Yeah. Sexuality, you know, is always there in one guise or other, but it may be that we're seeing higher rates of teenage pregnancy, for all I know. But the challenge is that schools need, we need to move beyond, for us in health, we need to move beyond seeing schools as platforms on which you can deliver programmatic actions to address problems. And again, that is, I'm afraid, a fairly standard political solution. You know, we've had a problem of sexual assault and rape in our parliament, and we've had students, young students, come out and share the extent to which they did not feel they consented to, you know, to sexual relationships taking place within multiple schools across Australia. On one hand, the natural response is, well, let's have a respectful relationships curriculum that be rolled out as one part of that. And whilst I would be fully supportive of that being one part of that, it cannot be the only part of that. And a health promoting schools approach is one that recognises that those programmatic interventions are part of that. The notion of really trying to align across a school, going from the highest level policy within the Department of Education and Training down to the leadership and support for teachers about their roles and responsibilities vis-à-vis individual students, then the decisions that individual schools are making about which programs they are putting in place are critically part of this work, as is, and what we haven't talked about at all, is a monitoring and evaluation framework.
Let's talk about the global standards, which are being launched on the 22nd. What are the eight pillars of those global standards?
So we've developed these eight global standards for health promoting schools, and part of developing these standards is really addressing the key barriers that we identified in our work and that others have identified in their work. And part of this is really raising to prominence the role of a governance system. Schools can't do this alone. They need a strong system of governance, strong policies to really support them. And so for that reason, our very first standard is government policies and resources. If we're thinking about mental health, and you know, to an extent, the Australian government does this very well. We've had lots of programs that have and initiatives that have been in Australia over the past few decades, things like the BU initiative, Mind Matters, Headspace. We've had the Respect program targeting violence, the Achievement program. So it's really thinking about some of those programs and initiatives that can be invested in, mandating mental health literacy as part of the curriculum, for example. And just really having that government level support in everything that we do. The second standard really focuses on school policies and resources. So again, at the school level, thinking about the policies that are in place, the extent to which they align with government policies, and thinking about how resources are allocated. So again, thinking about mental health as an example, this might be having anti-bullying policies or anti-harassment policies. Having policies around confidentiality. As we sort of have conceptualized these standards, the further down we move, I guess the closer we move to the day-to-day school operations. So our third standard is school governance and leadership. So we found from our work that really strong school leadership is really essential to implementing health promoting schools. So an example with mental health might be to promote and recognise diversity in school leadership and thinking about even having school health staff as part of the distributed model of leadership that you have in a school. Our fourth standard is around school and community partnerships. So recognising that health doesn't just happen within the walls of a school, within the boundaries of a school. It really is about engaging with the local community, with cultural groups, parents, creating opportunities for mentorship between students and community members, and just thinking about health extending beyond the walls of a school. Our fifth standard is around school curriculum, as we've spoken about already. You know, this is often what lots of people think about when they think about health in schools. I won't talk too much about that, but obviously that's still essential. It's still there as part of our standards. Standard six is around the school's social emotional environment. So again, thinking about that essence and atmosphere of the school, the quality of the day-to-day interactions between teachers and students. Mm-hmm. And I will just add here, we've been talking a lot about student outcomes, but health promoting schools is also about the school as a community. So interactions between teachers and other school staff, between teachers and parents, all of those relationships and how people feel within a school is important. Standard seven is the school physical environment, so ensuring that supports health and well-being. And with mental health, that might look like not having sort of hidden spaces around the schoolyard where bullying might occur, for example.
Yeah.
So really thinking through how does our physical environment support mental health. And then the final one is having school-linked health services. So really recognizing that health professionals, you know, doctors, nurses, psychologists, counsellors, social workers, etc., either physically located within the school or linked to the school in some way, are also a really important piece of the health promoting schools framework. You know, we would really encourage that those leadership models and those decision-making processes within a school incorporate those professionals as much as possible.
It strikes me that the government policies and the government resourcing and support is where you're going to have the most problem getting implementation done. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
I think that's fair, Kate. I think it's what the peer-reviewed evidence has shown us, and also in our public consultation with our expert advisory committees, the government support is the thing that is seen as very critical. And it's also the thing that historically has been really hard to achieve. And there's lots of reasons for why that might be. There's the sense that perhaps there's often a failure to fully appreciate the link between health and education. Mm-hmm. And even if it is appreciated, it might be hard to see what that looks like in practice. And I think that's what these standards are really trying to put into the spotlight. How do we work towards a sustainable and scalable health promoting school system?
If you had a magic wand, what would you fix right now to get this as part of normal routine life in Australia?
I would be ensuring that ministers of education had student health outcomes as part of their KPIs, as I would want ministers of health to have educational outcomes as their KPIs. We talk about multi-sectoral collaboration.
Yeah.
We talk about the health and education sectors needing to work more closely together, and health promoting schools is such a prime example of that. But until we live and breathe that at the highest level, it's so much harder for that to flow through to all of the levels that it needs to flow.
Monica?
I think for me it would be around education of educators and health professionals and any professionals working within schools, adjacent to schools, within government, something around professional development, pre-service and in-service, really focused on that link between health and education and really appreciating child and adolescent development and the aspects of that that really provide the foundation for young people to live full, healthy, engaged lives as citizens in, you know, in wherever they are.
Yeah.
Because I think that essence is really part of the foundation for ensuring that many of these things that we've spoken about today can really flourish. So that would be my wish.
Ruth?
Provided those wishes are granted, it would be really amazing to see national curricula and assessment frameworks recognise that student assessment needs to also look at the degree to which their health is being supported in a school. That would be amazing. In addition to our standardised achievement measures, I think that would really help us move the needle on support for this issue.
My thanks to my special guests today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts, or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.